Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm Daniel.
Today, we're back with another case for you today, one that will shake you to your core, quite honestly. It's probably one of the most disturbing cases we've ever covered.
Yeah, we haven't covered one like this in a while. It's a bit of a return to form for Lights Out here.
It is. And this case is the Nathan Brooks case. If you're not familiar with it, it draws some similarities to the Amityville murder case, which, if you know anything about that case, is also very, very brutal. And you know, there's some different theories there around, you know, what makes somebody snap all of a sudden and brutally murder their own parents. And there's kind of this paranormal element to this case that I think is a bit controversial, honestly.
Yeah.
But a lot of the people associated with this case, a lot of the locals in Blair, Ohio, where this takes place, believe that Nathan Brooks was demonically possessed at the time that these crimes took place. And of course, we'll dive into that further and really try to take a look at this from all the different angles. But these murders were so brutal, and there's also this element of Satanism and potentially a satanic cult being involved with Nathan, that the town literally canceled Halloween in October 1995, in the aftermath of these murders, which is crazy to think about. And the local media really, I don't know what the right word is, hyped this up and really instilled fear in all of the local residents about, you know, that there was this violent satanic cult that could potentially come to town and continue these killings that were going on. So
definitely an extension of the satanic panic of the time, right?
Right in the middle of the 90s.
Yeah.
Right at the height of all of it. So, yeah, it's a very, very disturbing case. But before we jump into that, I did want to mention that we are a finalist for the Signal Podcast Awards again this year, which, if you remember last year, we took home the Listener's Choice Award, which was thanks to all of you out there, all of our listeners and viewers, for going and voting for us, which that is the case again this year. We have a chance to win another Listener's Choice Award, which basically means out of the six finalists, we all go toe-to-toe, and our listeners get to decide who takes home that award, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. And I want another award.
Yeah.
Those things were heavy.
They are. They're legit. Year.
So even if you guys think our show is crap, vote for it so I can bring home an award.
Do it for Austin at the end of the day. But we are also a finalist in the paranormal or horror podcast category, same as last year, which is awesome. And the winner for, you know, the whole thing is judged by a bunch of industry plants. No, a bunch of industry professionals, you know, heads of media companies, podcast networks, all that kind of thing, audiophiles, all that good stuff. So just very excited to be chosen yet again. You know, we put a lot of work into this. Danny especially puts a ton of work in post-production for the show. So big shout out to Danny over there for continuing to kill it for us. Whoop, whoop. He's a man of few words, but behind the scenes, he's a wizard over there.
He's a workhorse.
He is a workhorse. We couldn't do it without you, man. And of course, big thank you to my beautiful co-host.
Oh,
just light of my world over here.
Wow.
He's a shining light in this dark, dark studio here.
Thank you so much.
But no, I think it's been, you know, we've been at this for, what is this, year or two now?
Yeah, I think.
Wrapping up year two?
I think technically my first episode was November of 2022. So yeah, we're coming up on the 2 year mark since I've been host. Well,
it's been an absolute joy.
Thanks,
to talk about this, all this very depressing, dark,
yeah,
dark stuff.
I wouldn't do it with anyone else, you know.
Yeah, no, it's been a true blast, and you know, just to see how Lights Out has evolved over the years, and from where it started in literally my backyard studio to now where we're at here, winning awards, and you know, we're also very close to hitting 500,000 subscribers on YouTube, which is crazy.
Coming up quick,
literally should get there before the end of the year. So. If you're not subscribed,
that's
help us out. Yeah. But no, it's just awesome. I just want to thank all of you out there for listening and supporting the show and, you know, being there along on this journey into the dark with us. We really appreciate everything you guys do, even all you haters out there. We love it. We love the talk, good or bad, you know.
Come at me a little bit more. Yeah. I need some more heat to keep me on my toes.
Exactly. So yeah, Signal Awards, there'll be a link if you want to vote for Lights Out for your listener's choice. That would be absolutely amazing of you to do that. And yeah, we'll report back on what ends up happening. But with that being said, let's go ahead and dive into the Nathan Brooks case. Nathan John Brooks was born on April 23rd, 1978 to Terry and Marilyn Brooks in the town of Belair, Ohio. Belair is a sleepy town with a population of less than 4,000 people, and it sits about 5 miles south of Wheeling along the Ohio River. It was a relatively safe and quiet town with close-knit communities. You know, everybody kept their doors unlocked, and you know, your typical small town, everybody knows everybody. And you know, it feels like every small town says that about themselves, you know?
yeah.
And I think it's true to a certain extent. You know, if you ever lived in a small town, it's definitely a unique experience. And I think a lot of people gravitate towards those places because they like the true feeling of community and everybody. You know, you go to the store and you see your neighbor, you see your classmates, you see your teachers, and it's this very, it's cool in some regards, but then in other cases, everybody knows everybody's business.
Everyone's up each other's butts.
Right. There's not the privacy that you'd find in a larger city or town. But in the mid-90s, during the Satanic Panic, Belair would experience the most disturbing and bizarre crimes in its entire history. Nathan Brooks was Terry and Marilyn's second son of three boys, and his older brother was Jamie, and his younger brother was named Ryan. Terry was a veteran of the Air Force and worked as a mailman in the 90s, and Marilyn worked as a pension clerk. And they all lived together in a small three-bedroom house on Margie Avenue, just outside of Belair in Pulteney Township. And the houses here were a bit more spread out compared to the homes in Belair proper. The Brooks had a big yard and plenty of privacy, but some neighbors were close enough to see what was happening in the Brooks household. Rumors spread about their father, Terry, having substance abuse issues with alcohol, and this often escalated his anger issues. But neighbors mostly had good things to say about the Brooks, but some of the rumors claimed that they could hear screaming matches coming from inside of the Brooks family home. So from the outside, it appeared like they were a normal family, but there was definitely a dark side going on behind closed doors. Marilyn's sister later confirmed that Terry was an alcoholic, and when he drank, he became abusive. Reportedly, Terry's favorite son was Ryan, the youngest, and he would even take off work to attend Ryan's football games. Marilyn's sister also confirmed that Terry could be very controlling over Marilyn, which put a strain on her and her sister's relationship. According to her, Terry was possessive and physically abusive toward Marilyn, but Marilyn kept believing that Terry could change. Marilyn's sister also claimed that Terry took out his anger on Nathan. At first, Nathan was a sweet, gentle, and happy kid, but when he was about 2 or 3 years old, Terry began calling him names to quote-unquote toughen him up and make a man out of him. And whenever Nathan cried, Terry would discipline him. Marilyn's sister described a change in Nathan over the years, and while playing, he would get very quiet and stare off into space with a worried look on his face. His former babysitter, Carol, later claimed that she watched as Nathan grew from a happy child into a young adult who was, quote, sullen and withdrawn from his father's abuse. Which to me, all of this makes sense. You know, if you're dealing with abuse like this, especially from a young age, it's going to have a major impact on your development.
Yeah, it sets the stage, right? So the Brooks neighbor, Debbie, described Nathan as a, quote, normal kid, a little quiet, a little shy, but well-mannered and friendly. He was also heavily involved in his Catholic church growing up, which I believe was St. John's, and he served as an altar boy, and he also expressed an interest in joining the priesthood early on, which is interesting for a young boy. I didn't know many, even in Catholic school, that impressed interest in becoming a priest, but supposedly he was close with his local priest, George Yance, and this is who he expressed these interests to. So early on, Nathan was seen as intelligent and socially witty, and Father Yance once described him as, quote, generous, gentlemanly, quiet, and pleasant. From a young age, he dove into Christian texts, especially the Bible. And while he was a teenager and still devoutly Christian, two close friends of Nathan's passed away really close to each other in the same year. One passed from brain tumor complications while the other committed suicide. And according to Nathan, it was actually during these funerals that he acknowledged he was a bit different than everyone else because most people grieved at these funerals, but Nathan, for whatever reason, he could only think about what would happen to his friends' body parts after they were dead. And he didn't really feel any strong emotions after they had died. So it was around this time when his fascination with other belief systems spread even wider, including occult and satanic circles. He began hanging satanic imagery on his bedroom walls. He also collected literature like the Book of the Dead, which was an Egyptian guidebook that provided spells for the afterlife. He also picked up on, you could guess it, Anton LaVey's The Satanic Rituals that outlined 9 group rituals and ceremonies. Plus, I know the Satanic Bible was in the mix as well. I believe The Satanic Rituals is like a companion piece to that book. He also read about Jack the Ripper and Jeffrey Dahmer, and he also had a book called Whoever Fights Monsters by FBI veteran Robert K. Ressler. And some of you might know the character Bill Tench from Mindhunter, which was one of my favorite shows on Netflix canceled too early. But Agent Ressler from that book inspired the character of Bill Tench. Fun little factoid. The book was about his interviews during the formation of the Behavioral Analysis Unit in the FBI, which, as we know, they were basically the front runners for uncovering psychopathic killers, right? Serial killers, especially in that regard.
We don't have an exact age that he necessarily began diving into this. It seems like probably early teens.
High school. Yeah. That's what I'm assuming.
14, 15. I mean, it's like pretty, it's obviously heavy subject matter. So
right.
I'm sure an elementary kid's not going to just run across these books.
Right.
But like, what do you make of this? Do you think it's that weird that he's getting into this stuff, or is it just kind of out of curiosity type of thing?
I don't think it's that strange. I would definitely want to have, if this was my kid and I found him with all these books, I would definitely want to maybe crack open some discussions about them and why he's so interested in them.
Totally.
But I don't think it's necessarily just an immediate red flag. Because I don't know, a lot of us and a lot of our listeners are fascinated with the same things: serial killers, FBI agents, Anton LaVey. Like, I don't think it's inherently worrisome. But what do you think?
I think looking at it through the lens of his family, I could see why they would be concerned. Right? I mean, he grows up Catholic. He was an altar boy. He was, you know. One day he went from reading the Bible and now he's reading the Satanic Bible.
Right.
And I'm sure that would be, I know if I showed up with my parents with a Satanic Bible, they'd freak.
Yeah.
You know, they'd be like, what do you, even if I was just like, I'm just curious, I'm just looking at it. It's the idea that even opening yourself up to these topics, opens up sort of a gateway for, you know, dark forces to enter your mind and stuff, which is a big, big topic within this case. But I think if you're just, again, like you said, having a conversation with your kid about it and be like, well, are you interested in doing the things that these books are talking about, or are you just doing it from purely a curiosity standpoint, just because you're maybe you're interested in going into law enforcement or something like that? Like for mm-hmm. me, that was the case when I was looking at some, not necessarily the Satanic Bible or Book of the Dead, but looking at like the FBI agent's book or serial killers, things like that. In my teens, that would be because I was interested in law enforcement. And so the natural curiosity is there just right. from that standpoint. But it's definitely, like you said,
why do you,
what's the intention yeah, behind it? Like, are yeah. you wanting to fall in the footsteps of these people, or are you just wanting yeah. to learn? So
I actually knew a kid in Catholic school who brought a copy of the Satanic Bible. He had it in his locker,
oh,
which
wow.
I thought was a pretty bold move. But when he talked to me about it, that was actually the first time I was ever introduced to it. But he did it more of as an act of protest and was just interested in more the anti-Christian sentiments or like anti-organized religion sentiments that were in it. He wouldn't hurt a fly. He was a super nice right. kid, like, and he's doing fine today, right? So yeah, I guess it just depends on your motivations behind the literature, I guess. But outside of his interest in books, it's also worth noting that in Nathan's free time, he dabbled in hallucinogenics in his teenage years. He also began sneaking into an abandoned house in town and performing satanic rituals at night. He would go in and paint the walls with satanic symbols and attempt to contact Satan himself. The woman who owned the abandoned home eventually found out, so one night she kind of kept an eye on the place and chased him away once he showed up. He continued to go back, I think, but not as much after that. Meanwhile, his older brother, Jamie, went off to college at Ohio State University, and when Nathan was 17, he spent the summer with his brother, Jamie, and Jamie's wife in Columbus, which is where Ohio State University is. He also got a summer job in a nursing home nearby, and here, his strange obsession with dead bodies got even worse, and he actively began searching for patients on the verge of death so he could observe them.
See, this is where things are taking a turn already.
Something's not right here.
Because that's not normal behavior.
No.
That's not just out of curiosity. I mean, you're doing satanic rituals, so you're following the rituals within the Satanic Bible. You're taking it one step further, and now you're actively seeking out dead bodies. So there was clearly a point in which something changed. And we'll talk about, you know, what people theorize about this, but could it have just started from him becoming rebellious against his parents because of the things he was experiencing at home through the abuse? And, you know, I feel like every teenager is rebellious in some way, shape, or form. And the abuse coupled with just being a rebellious teen, and then also consuming this type of literature, and then taking even a step further, is just kind of all creating this perfect storm, it seems like.
Yeah, and it's important to remember his two friends passing.
Yeah, that's very impactful too. Yeah.
And also him admitting, like, I didn't really feel emotional, I just thought about their bodies. So clearly something's not right even early on. And I think it's important to remember all these tidbits leading up to this, because people do like to propose that all of a sudden it just like came out of nowhere and Nathan Brooks right. all of a sudden did this. But I think we can kind of see the storm on the horizon here, especially what his older brother discovered, because one day Jamie found Nathan was keeping animal bones inside his bedroom, and he also suspected Nathan of mutilating neighborhood cats. On another day, Jamie's wife found a lamb skull in Nathan's room, along with a book about the occult. And allegedly, Nathan had stolen a lamb from the university's agricultural department, slaughtered it, and then kept the skull. That hasn't been confirmed, but that is the allegation. Jamie soon confronted Nathan about the odd souvenirs that he kept in his room, and Nathan promised, "This is just a weird phase that I'm going through," but really, this phase continued on and on. And while he stayed in Columbus that summer, Nathan befriended two self-proclaimed Wiccan witches Apparently, they reinforced Nathan's hobby of animal bone collection, and he would also describe his odd fantasies and thoughts to them pretty openly. And when he proclaimed that he was, in fact, evil, the witches agreed. So, even early on, he was just admitting he's evil. According to Nathan, one day while working at the nursing home, he targeted a man walking by on the sidewalk, and while he was armed with a knife, Nathan approached him, apparently ready to kill the man, but Nathan abandoned the attack when a car ran out of the corner and drove past them. Even though he didn't attack the man, he would later say that he got a thrill out of the idea of murdering him. After that summer, he returned home from Ohio State, and many noticed a significant change in him. After that summer, he moved back in with his parents and began his senior year at Bel Air High School. So some of his classmates and teachers noticed how withdrawn he had become, and they also saw him drawing satanic symbols in his notebooks and his school assignments. He would often write things like, quote, "God is dead, Satan is good." And he would sign school papers with, quote, "Nathan Brooks, Master of Death." And on the school bus, he once even scratched another student and drew blood. So clearly he's acting out here. Part of me is like, it seems like edgelord behavior. So there's nothing, if I was maybe a teacher and someone was like, "God is dead, Satan is good," I wouldn't be like immediately like, "Oh my God, something is seriously wrong here." But it would definitely maybe start to set off some red flags. And we'll see that it doesn't stop here, because he soon was sent to the school counselor for these exact comments. Her name was Amy Farmer. She thought Nathan was very nice at first, which if you ask a lot of the people he went to school with and family friends, they all thought he was just this nice kid. But she noticed he had actually brought Anton LaVey's The Satanic Bible to school with him. And one day he turned to her and threatened to cut off her head and dump her body on the side of the road. He also confessed to her that he was smoking marijuana, abusing homemade LSD, and huffing butane, sometimes up to 2 cans a day. And when asked why, Nathan claimed the butane helped free him of, quote, "obsessive thoughts."
I've never even heard of huffing butane. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Can only imagine. I mean, I'm sure that's horrible for your brain.
Destroying brain cells. The counselor then called Nathan's mom, Marilyn, to fill her in on her son's behavior. And Marilyn argued, the same as Nathan once did, that, hey, this is just a phase and he'll get through it.
So she finds out that he says, "I'm going to decapitate my school counselor and dump her body on the side of the road." And she thinks it's just a phase.
Yeah. Ooh. I think
a little bit more intervention needs to happen at this point. I mean, that's not just there's a lot of phases in development, but
that sounds like a cry for help.
Yeah.
You're telling a school counselor that you're going to kill them. That seems like there's something seriously wrong here, right? And even if he's not even genuine about that statement, that's clearly like he wants the alarms to go off here, but for whatever reason, they're really not.
Yeah. That's crazy. I mean, I think we all knew people like that who were doing extreme things like that, saying crazy stuff for attention, mm-hmm. for people to, you know, be scared of them, whatever they were trying to get out of it. But when you're taking it to that point, and then you find out that he's also using substances and that are also mind altering, I mean, you've got a recipe for disaster brewing right before you. It seems like something more drastic needs to be done.
Definitely.
But maybe, you know, maybe it's hard to say like what, you know, it's probably very abnormal to see this kind of stuff. And maybe they really did think it was just a phase and he was always this nice kid. And so maybe they thought, oh, he'll just shake it off somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of like one of the mysteries of this case is like, why? Like what exactly happened here?
Right. In the last week of September 1995, many noticed Nathan's behavior getting even worse. He began ignoring his classmates, and he also showed up to the house of his old babysitter, Carol. And while on her doorstep, he confessed his love for her. She noticed he was very thin and fidgety, and when asked if something was wrong, he told her not to worry. Carol then called Marilyn, his mother, and warned her about the odd behavior, but she brushed it off. She didn't seem very worried about it.
And then that Saturday, on September 30th, 1995, Marilyn was relaxing at home since she had just returned from a work conference recently in Florida. Terry would also be home later, but Nathan's younger brother, Ryan, was out of the house and spent the day with his best friend, Eric Baratti. They later headed out to a high school football game that evening. According to Nathan, that night when Marilyn and Terry went to bed, he snuck around the house with a bolt-action hunting rifle, a hatchet, and a knife. At the time, his parents slept in separate rooms. In his father's room, Nathan shot 53-year-old Terry Brooks 3 times in the head, point blank. He then armed himself with a hatchet, entered his mother's room, and struck 51-year-old Marilyn Brooks in the back of the head. He then stabbed her 10 times in the abdomen with the knife. Returning to Terry's body, he decapitated him with a hacksaw. Nathan then covered her body with a comforter and also placed a hammer and long metal nails at the foot of the bed. A medical examination claimed that Marilyn's body showed wounds of being pinned against the wall before being placed back into the bed. According to Nathan, he had originally planned to crucify her. He later described the experience in a taped confession, saying, quote, "It wasn't like my mom, like the woman I loved. It was like skin, like an animal, like a dog." He also planned to cut his father in half after decapitating him, but didn't. Instead, after removing his father's head, he wrapped it in paper and then placed it inside a large wash basin in his bedroom, and then he sprinkled ashes around the head. He claimed he performed this as a ritual in order to increase his power, and at some point during the night, he also performed a black mass, which, as we mentioned a few episodes ago, for the uninitiated, in satanic circles, a black mass is a ceremony that is meant to be blasphemous and sacrilegious to the Catholic Church. In a way, it's a parody of the Catholic Mass. In modern day, it's mostly used as a form of protest, but despite its long history, there is no set of instructions for performing a black mass until about the 1960s in the United States, and most rules were drawn from occult novelists and occult nonfiction writers. Still, there is no definite, all-encompassing instructions for doing a black mass.
Some claim he did it in the house after the murders, potentially even with the body parts, just to clarify, and some people say he waited and went to a cemetery later to do it, but it's unclear really what happened.
But Nathan said he felt love from Satan after killing his parents. After the black mass, Nathan considered killing more people, but decided not to ultimately. Before he left the scene of the crime, he looked at himself in the mirror, paused, and then cut himself. Around 1:45 a.m. that night, Nathan's little brother Ryan was over at a schoolmate's house with his friend Eric. He wanted to spend the night, so he called the Brooks family's home phone, expecting one of his parents to answer. Instead, Nathan answered, and he told Ryan that their parents wanted him to come back. Nathan later said, quote, "I wanted him to be with my mom and my dad. I was going to kill him." Eric then drove Ryan back to the Brooks house around 2:45 a.m. and reportedly they had seen Marilyn's car on the road and they figured that she was on her way to Eric's in order to pick up Ryan. But it was actually Nathan driving their mother's car. And he showed up at Eric's house a few minutes later, waking up his parents. Eric's mother, Pat, answered the door and she told him that his brother wasn't there. Meanwhile, Ryan and Eric arrived at the Brooks family home and Ryan hopped out of the car, and as he walked up towards the house, he noticed that all the lights were on inside, which was super weird because it's 3 a.m. and he figured all of his whole family would be asleep, and he knew that his father had work in the morning, and he immediately knew that something was off, so Eric joined him. As they stepped inside his home, they immediately discovered the bodies of Ryan's parents. Both were deceased at this point. He figured an intruder must have killed them, so Eric and Ryan immediately left the house and then drove over to a nearby fire station. Eric's father, Dennis, caught wind something was wrong at the Brooks house, so he drove by the Brooks family's house to check on it. Emergency vehicles were scrambling around the neighborhood. Dennis then drove over to the local fire station where Ryan and Eric were, and emergency services had already been called. They also called Eric's mom, Pat, who was back at their home, to let her know what was going on, and they mentioned that Nathan was missing, and no one knew where he was. Allegedly, Pat witnessed Nathan entering her home sometime later, and he stole some of Eric's clothes before leaving. The family also later discovered that he had stabbed a note and an envelope filled with money into their door with a steak knife. The note was addressed to his brother Ryan, and it said, quote, "Hey, this is Nathan. I murdered 2 people, and I'm going to turn myself in. I left some money for you. P.S. If Eric or his dad steals this money, I swear I'll come back and fuck them up."
love Nathan.
Police later found Marilyn's car near the Bel Air Cemetery off Winding Hill Road at 3:33 a.m. Nathan was later picked up walking towards Eric's neighborhood wearing clean clothes. According to police, Nathan immediately asked, quote, "Did my brother see them? I know I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done it." A deputy described Nathan as dark and distant, and his eyes were black and empty. Once back at the station, he gave Belmont County Sheriff Tom McCourt a full, detailed confession of his crimes. His brother Jamie and a social worker were also present.
So he explained to the sheriff that he had been full of hate and anger from a young age. This was during his confession. And after the murders, he said he felt better. He had tried to stop his obsessive urges, but he couldn't. He said, quote, "I need help. It keeps coming, even now, everybody in this room." He also didn't blame occultism or Satanism for what had happened, saying, quote, "It was my fault. I need to be punished." He also mentioned he wanted to visit his priests and also confessed he had originally planned to go on a killing spree. This was later confirmed as investigators searched the Brooks family home, and along with the rifle, bow saw, axe, and hatchet in Nathan's bedroom, and satanic pictures and letters across his walls, they found an odd list of names on Nathan's desk. This list would go on to cause absolute mayhem in Bel Air. So his brother Ryan was the first name listed, and on the page Nathan had written times of all which had been crossed out, and he had also drawn sketches of Satan and a pentagram. At the top he jotted, quote, "Satan will show you peace." Next to his brother's name were the words, quote, "Dismember, decapitate." Second on the list was mother, and next to it was eviscerate, crucify. Third on the list was father, and next to it, decapitate. It's not clear how many more names were written on this list. One source claimed there were at least 13 names, including Amber, Lisa, Justin, Jason, Ryan, Dave, Corey, Jill, Mike, Ashley. Some of these names were grouped together, others were solitary. Next to some of the names, Nathan wrote, quote, "molest." Next to others, he wrote, quote, "skin." And next to two more names was, quote, "dismember, eviscerate." Two of the names were crossed out entirely. So investigators theorized that Nathan had planned to carry out more murders of the people that he listed who were potential friends and classmates. It was people that he knew. But it wasn't known if Nathan was working alone or potentially with a secret satanic cult that had infested Bel Air. So they kind of jumped straight to this theory that there were more people involved.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, they had never seen something like this before.
Right. Yeah.
So this is just so out of left field. It just seems like the absolute worst of the worst has happened. And there's all these names and, you know, he had just, you know, murdered his parents. And in the ways that he murdered them was just absolutely brutal. Many of the officers had never seen anything like that. I believe some of the officers even were puking after viewing the crime scene. It was just that gruesome.
Yeah, I remember one was saying in that one documentary, he was saying that was the worst he had ever seen in
and
his
he had
entire
been to
career.
Tons of different yeah. crime scenes before.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just unbelievable. And, you know, I think just being witness to that, you know, may make you think irrationally and think
panic.
There's
yeah.
got to be something more to that. Because there's a lot, there's people that are like, how could he have done this all on his own?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Which we'll get into in a bit. But, you know, from like law enforcement's perspective, if this is the craziest thing they'd ever seen before, I could kind of see how they might think other people may be involved. There's this whole list. Are there other people on their way to these people on this list?
Right.
So it could definitely cause some panic there.
And he was picked. He didn't turn himself in. We know this. You know, he was walking towards Eric's neighborhood. So it's like, was he trying to continue the spree as well? So,
and thank God they found him when they did.
Right.
Because, yeah, things would have got even worse.
Yeah. So by October 2nd, local newspapers began running this story. And this is where everything just starts to go crazy. Local panic set in. And after the list was publicized, the people of Bel Air spread rumors that there was this underground cult of Satanists. They were conspiring to kill several more people in town and use their bodies for satanic rituals.
Seems like a bad move to put the list out there publicly.
I know. That's why.
How is that going to help anything?
Who's ever the intelligence on the police side, why release that to the public? That seems like a bad move. And I think it's this small town thing where it's like, we've never dealt with something this crazy before. So they were treading new ground. They really didn't know what to do as far as the
public.
But
why not just go tell the people on the list, like, hey, you were on this list that we found,
right.
Nathan, you know, be careful. Like, might be a good idea to up security here for a little bit till we figure this out.
True.
But to just like put it out to everybody in town,
yeah, you know,
it's going to freak people out.
And I think the local newspapers didn't do anything to help. They were stirring the pot even worse than anybody else was. And they were kind of buying into the hype of the satanic panic. So rumors also suggested that Nathan was demonically possessed during his killing spree. And this was what we were referencing earlier. And he had possibly opened himself up to possession through his occult interests. Others believe that even if he wasn't fully possessed, he might have been somewhere along the process. And so there is, this is like a manufactured list, but people kind of abide by this.
Demonologists usually refer to these steps in
exactly
the possession process.
So this it starts with what's called infestation, which is the person afflicted might be seeing apparitions, hearing footsteps, smelling odd odors. The second is oppression, which is you're actually being physically attacked. There's sleep disturbances. You might be, your mental health might be afflicted with depression, anxiety. You might just have personal problems going on in your life, financial issues, you know, just personal stress. The third is obsession, which is basically you're starting to just, you're functioning. It's hard to operate in your day to day. You might have suicidal thoughts. You're not getting any sleep at all. And finally, the fourth and final is possession, which is where obviously the demon just has seized control. So those who believe that he was possessed claim that Nathan didn't have the strength to saw his father's head off. So he must have been assisted somehow by someone or something. And some people suggest that it could have been a demon. They also point out that Nathan often smelled rotting flesh, which could be an indication of a demonic presence. And this smell of rotting flesh will come up a bit later in the case during the trial. Others thought Nathan might have been doing favors for Satan with the belief that maybe he'll be reincarnated or maybe he'll be saved in the afterlife somehow. Personally, I don't buy it, but what do you think?
I think it comes down to what you believe, right?
Yeah.
I think belief comes into this case quite a bit. And like I mentioned at the beginning, a lot of people in town that were indirectly or directly connected to the case seem to really have some religious beliefs about this.
And for sure.
That also, on the flip side, there was some divine intervention when it comes to Ryan.
His brother, yeah.
And the fact that Ryan wasn't at the house when he showed up was, you know, divine intervention in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's all really interesting. I think it can be a bit dangerous to go all in on that. I think it's interesting to think about and consider, but I think we have to stay rooted in reality a little bit here and also look at the other evidence at play here, specifically around Nathan, his mental health, and his history as well. I think it's a little bit easier to jump to demonic possession being the explanation for what happened, because it fits the narrative of the belief system,
right?
For those that believe in this, really. I mean, it's like it makes it a little bit more convenient to process and
agreed.
Understand when the truth might be far more complex and
hidden to some degree. It
yeah,
might be a mystery.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well put. Well said. That I agree completely.
It's difficult because if I, you know, I'm trying to look at this from a purely logical standpoint, but I do understand just based on, you know, if we're talking about belief systems, I understand that if you delve into a dark, you know, topics like this, and then you start acting upon these things, I personally believe that it can negatively affect your mind. But I don't think it's necessarily the single driving force behind why he did what he did. I wouldn't go as far to say that I for sure think he was demonically possessed, because there's no way to prove that in any way, shape, or form.
That's the problem. Yeah.
And it's a bit dangerous, in my opinion, to go that far and be like, it was a demonic possession that led to this happening, because I think there's just so many other factors that what would a demon have anything to do with?
Right. I mean? And that's why the only speculation they have really is the sawing of the head.
Right.
Like the strength, and then the rotting flesh smell. Those were like the two things that people who believe in this theory brought up. I also think it kind of undermines responsibility. If you could just say, oh, it was a demon. Well, then it's like, where do we go from here with Nathan then? Because if he's demonically possessed, then that also just makes him a victim as well. And what do we do with that? Especially within the systems of the courts. Like,
yeah,
there's exactly nowhere to go with that information, unfortunately.
It goes back to the Devil Made Me Do It case, you exactly, know, Arnie Johnson. Yep. And in that case, it's a slippery slope to try to bring that to the courts, you know what
right.
I mean? So you've got to remove belief from it and look at the facts, the hard evidence that you can point to that does hold up in court to really try to understand. And also, how do you, like you said, how do you hold him accountable for this?
Right.
It's impossible to prove in a court of law if somebody's demonically possessed, because it's all based on interpretation and belief.
Yep.
You know what I mean? There's science hasn't yet proven that demons are real, or that really even the divine is real at this point. Right. So it's a very difficult place to navigate. And I understand why in this town, you know, and, you know, many of the people are church going people, and, you know, this is their belief system that they believe with all their heart, mind, and soul. But I think there's a lot of other things here that there's so many layers to this that you have to look through before you can just jump to it was a demon that possessed him. Cause you know, it's like, he had inhuman strength in order to do the killings the way that he did. Well, it could just be adrenaline from what he was physically doing, you know?
Right. That's a good point too.
There's a lot of psychological things that happen, and also just unknown things that happen within the brain that science can't explain. That doesn't necessarily lend it straight to this is some type of supernatural force. You know what I mean?
What rubbed me the wrong way is they were so quick to discard the psychiatrists, the multiple psychiatrist diagnoses. They were like, oh no, it's because they don't really consider the supernatural aspect. But I was like, well, you're not considering the psychiatric aspect as well. Because my problem with their research is like, you don't propose a hypothesis and then try to prove that hypothesis. You propose a hypothesis and it could be proven wrong during your research. So it seemed like a lot of the people that were proposing this theory were just kind of seeing what they wanted to see and had confirmation bias to try and get there. And they were kind of ignoring a lot of the other factors of this case.
Yeah, really good point.
But with that said, if there was some demonic energy in this world, this case seems to line up
right
perfectly with that. So I get where it comes from as well. The local newspapers fueled these satanic cult rumors. One newspaper claimed that Nathan's plan was to kill up to 30 people, and if he couldn't finish the task, other members of his cult would. Another newspaper claimed that Nathan allegedly told his friends, quote, I'm going to be famous by Saturday. This is a controversial and unverified quote, but it was still published in the local papers. If you look up this case, I guarantee you'll come across that quote, but no one could actually confirm that he said this. Other students later claimed they heard Nathan talking about killing his parents, and at the time, no one believed he was serious, like we were saying, people just saying crazy stuff to get attention, maybe. But as the rumor spread, many assumed Nathan might have had accomplices through school and other social circles. Bel Air councilwoman Lou Ann Bennett had a daughter, Bobby Jo, who was a schoolmate of Nathan's, She said, quote, "Everyone was worried that these devil worshippers would do something to the kids. No one knew for sure. No one knew that that satanic stuff was taking place around here." So on the Monday night after the murders, over a dozen students at Bel Air High went to the counseling office, and nearby high schools also offered support if Bel Air High needed any resources, which I think was nice.
Rumors had also gotten so bad by then that the public thought that the hit list had up to 40 names on it, including the name of a local priest. Some theories even claim the police knew about the murders before they happened, so the rumor mill is just going absolutely insane, just making the case that much worse and probably the investigation way more difficult to sort out the truth. Bel Air Police Chief Robert Wallace said there was nowhere near 40 names, and he said he was absolutely not calling what they found a quote-unquote hit list. Apparently, their intelligence officer was responsible for starting the hit list rumor in the first place. Chief Wallace also told the public that authorities concluded no one else was involved. Even Nathan himself said he acted alone. But still, the rumors around this murder satanic cult continued. And this happened a lot during the height of the satanic panic, where, you know, some type of satanic ritual killing, even if it looked remotely like that, automatically jumped to there's got to be more out there. There's no way this is just an isolated incident or one person. It's like this thought that they only exist in groups.
Yeah. Cause I think of people when they see, like, you know, Catholic church, you go, it's a congregation, it's a community. There's a bunch of people there. So they think the flip side, like, it's of the satanic,
set up the same way.
Yeah. Like they're going to black mass together. There's
a leader. And there's others that the. And not saying that that's never the case, but I mean, we're talking about a small town in Bel Air, Ohio. You know, what are the chances that there's, you know, more people involved in this beyond Nathan, especially based on the evidence that they found right off the bat? I think it would have been much more clear. So then now it's kind of grasping at straws, being like, well, could they come from elsewhere? Was he in contact with some other group that made him do this or something like that? So it's just spiraling out of control.
Yeah.
In the abandoned house where Nathan would perform many of his rituals, investigators found a pentagram painted on one of the walls along with the word Lucifer. The public theorized this was a potential gathering place for the secret satanic cult to meet. Belmont County Sheriff Tom McCourt tried his best to stop these rumors, and he told the public he had spent a long time speaking with Nathan. During those conversations, Nathan admitted that when he told people about his beliefs, they thought he was goofy. They weren't interested in following him or joining a cult. According to Sheriff McCourt, the only people remotely interested in Nathan and his beliefs were the two self-proclaimed witches he met in Columbus. Nathan was eventually charged with two counts of aggravated murder and using a firearm in commission of a felony. Preliminary hearings were held to determine if 17-year-old Nathan Brooks could be tried as an adult. The presiding judge put a gag order on the case and banned the press from attending these hearings, which probably a good move on his part.
Yeah.
But of course, because a gag order was put in place, this just fueled the rumors even more, because they're like, backfires. Oh, they're hiding stuff. They don't want us to know how bad this is.
You just can't win.
No, right? No. Outside of the hearings, Nathan was held at Sargis Juvenile Center. And according to state law in Ohio, a child over the age of 15 who had committed a felony and was deemed beyond rehabilitation and an active danger to the public could be tried as an adult. A motion to lift the gag order was denied, but photos of Nathan with a cloth covering his head while being escorted to the courtroom were still allowed. The media continued publishing conflicting articles about Nathan, trying to answer the question of why. Schoolmates tried to piece together how Nathan presented himself at school, and not many agreed. Some claimed there was never anything off about him, and others said that they could tell that something wasn't right about him from a young age. Many classmates described him as nice but quiet, and some noticed that he had been withdrawn in the past year. As for the strange satanic writings and sketches, some saw it as a cry for help. Others mentioned that he was often jealous of his younger brother and fought with his parents. But that wasn't out of the ordinary for a teenager, and most of his schoolmates would be left confused. And they had to wait until Nathan's trial began, which would reveal more details about Nathan's past as well as the nature of his heinous crimes. While incarcerated at Sargis Juvenile Center, Nathan met with a local priest, George Yance, who said Nathan seemed remorseful and, quote, was most gracious and pleased that I'd come. I know he's hurt. He has to live with that for the rest of his life. I don't think we ought to judge Nathan. There has been a struggle from the time of creation between good and bad, and most of us human beings find bad things easier to do than the good things. I think he was just led into being influenced by these counter forces. Meanwhile, on October 5th, a memorial service was held for Terry and Marilyn at St. John the Evangelist Roman Catholic Church in Bel Air, and about 100 people attended. They were buried in Davis Cemetery, and Nathan was not allowed to attend or visit the cemetery, but according to Father Yontz, Nathan's older brother Jamie had tried to maintain a relationship between them while Nathan was held at the juvenile center. According to local newspapers, on the day after the funeral services, two of Nathan's classmates were found in the cemetery after dark. It was reported that one of the burial plots had been dug up. Although it's unclear when or which burial was disturbed, a red flag was placed nearby. Sheriff McCourt said the classmates were found walking and talking, and despite his best efforts to calm down the locals, this fueled the rumors even more. The classmates were accused of being cult worshippers and digging up the graves. To this day, these rumors still persist in Bel Air. In the early morning of October 6th, the local fire department had been called to the abandoned house where Nathan had once performed the rituals. The house ended up being burned to the ground. That same day, someone broke into the Brooks family household, and it appeared that possibly up to three people had broken into the basement window. When officers arrived at the scene, they discovered a new makeshift altar with a chalice on top outside of the home, and it's believed that animals have been sacrificed here. Investigators also discovered videotapes about satanic rituals, an elaborate medallion with tiny skulls on it, and a blue candle. They also discovered a shell casing from a .22 caliber bullet and a new list of names inside a trash can that appeared to be covered in blood. Investigators then discovered that the Brooks property shed had one of its doors removed, and fresh dirt was discovered on two of the shovels inside. Only 2 days later, on October 8th around 1:30 a.m., a fire broke out in the front yard of the home. The fire department managed to put it out before it spread beyond the front porch, and local authorities thought it was just a prank. But they later discovered a trail of gasoline had been poured from the front yard to the house, where a pile of rags also soaked in gasoline rested. Local newspapers then ran articles about the occult's history in Bel Air, and it said violence among teens involving the occult was likely increasing. So just panic's going full-blown snowball, you know, down the mountain. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. And they're eating it up, right? Because it's like more and more people are buying their papers. And
do you think, you know, this makeshift altar where they think maybe animals were sacrificed and these occult videotapes, do you think that's indicative of other satanic worshipers around the area? Do you think it's just some pranksters trying to leave behind some random stuff to escalate the rumors? Like, what do you think that is?
I think the most likely scenario is that people are capitalizing on this to just spread more fear and hype it up even more.
Yeah.
It seems like the authorities lean that way as well, based on everything they found. It was like, what are the chances? Especially if you just, like, why would any cult want to risk, you know, being caught or having the authorities on their tail?
That's a great point.
And like, associating themselves with Nathan whatsoever.
Yeah. No, if this cult was real, they'd be quiet as a mouse.
Right.
Right?
So it makes no sense. So the most likely scenario is that this was just a bunch of kids, you know, trying to
pranks,
make matters worse,
yeah,
and scare everybody even more.
Yeah.
On October 9th, Sheriff McCourt tried to calm the local neighbors by lying to them. He said that no one had tried to break into the Brooks family home, even though that was untrue, as confirmed by locals who were listening in to police scanners and neighborhood eyewitnesses. So that's not a good move either. Now you're losing trust in the public, and the public now thinks you're lying to them about what's really going on. So it's just, everything's completely out of control.
Mm-hmm.
The police later publicly called out the unknown vandals, stating that there were two other children in the Brooks family and this property was a monetary asset to the surviving victims. Meanwhile, Terry's former employees and local post offices raised money for a college fund for Ryan Brooks.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
And I like the sympathetic appeal where it's like, look, if you want to screw around, whatever, but this is people's livelihoods here. So maybe consider that before being an idiot. So I like that they're at least as much as maybe they're screwing up the public information here, I appreciated that, you know?
Because, yeah, you have to remember Ryan and his other brother, Jamie, they're just trying to deal with the aftermath of this. They just lost their parents in the most brutal way possible. Their brothers.
Now they're losing their brother.
They're losing their brother. They're trying to make sense of what happened.
Yeah.
And then people are just making it perpetually worse.
Right.
Unfortunately, things didn't get calmer from here. The local mayhem continued when bomb threats were called into the high school football field and other facilities, and it was reported that some student athletes had police escorts to school football games. Police canine units and teams of firefighters would also check locker rooms, team buses, and the surrounding stadium structures for bombs. For the town of Bel Air, football games were community events where everyone could rally behind him. It's huge, right? In the wake of a tragedy, it really helped the town heal. It's where everybody comes together, kind of forget about the horrible thing that just happened and come together as humans, right?
Supposedly their team was really good. And they even had maybe a few NFL stars come out of Bel Air High. So football was a huge deal in this town.
Yeah, it's Ohio, man. Yeah. Ohio's a huge football.
Yep. And Ohio State. Yeah. Yep. It's huge.
One unnamed local parent told the media that her children were now scared of their friends and no longer trusted anyone since they used to eat lunch with Nathan. Even though authorities conducted these escorts and inspections, authorities told the public there was no reason to take these threats seriously. But police soon noticed a rise in gun sales. Which, how can you fault people?
Right. I don't blame them.
They're terrified.
Yeah.
They're seeing all this in the media and hearing all these rumors, and seems like things are just kind of out of control. So I totally get it. You want to protect yourself.
I get it too. So here's a quote from Police Chief Robert Wallace trying to calm the local panic. Quote, Bel Air is made up of God-fearing, hardworking, taxpaying people who won't easily get upset by talks such as this. But the sheer amount of rumor and innuendo has caused an increase in the amount of fear in the churches, schools, and workplaces. He's basically saying, look, you guys are good people. We're a bit better than this, though. So maybe chill. On October 12th, a public meeting was held at a local fire station. 150 local people came to talk to the authorities about their concerns. The media was barred from this meeting, but witnesses to the meeting later claimed it had turned into a, quote, sheriff bashing session. Because of the fear and panic, Mayor Tino Esposito recommended that no one go trick-or-treating on Halloween, which was still several weeks away. But he said that no one would be arrested if they were seen going door-to-door, but basically for the community, Halloween was effectively canceled that year.
Which makes people feel unsafe.
Right.
Even though mayor obviously feels unsafe if he's like going to this drastic of a step to effectively keep his community safe. You know, he's like, we don't want any kids out there because we just don't know.
Yeah. Which is scary because it's almost kind of confirming that there is something to be scared of, right? So in response, the local PTA and the Bel Air Clergy Association held a Halloween party at a local park. They called it Boo Bash. Everyone in the community was invited, and they stressed it was specifically not a religious event, just a safe place with adult supervision so children could still celebrate the holiday. But some clergy members urged children to dress up as Bible characters instead of ghosts or vampires. One of the priests from the local Catholic church was also quoted saying, quote, Halloween may not be evil enough on the surface, but there is nothing innocent about it. It is very serious. So it's like, man, you're trying you're trying to do something like to get the community back and some positive spirits. But of course, the local priest is like, still evil afoot.
Yeah, I don't see how that helps anything whatsoever.
I'm sorry. No one wants to dress up as Bible characters.
No. Been there, done that.
Yeah, true.
Literally have done that in my childhood. Yeah. Yep. Was not allowed to be anything scary for a number of years.
Yeah.
Nothing fun
about that. Never is. We had a local house that they didn't celebrate Halloween, so they always like taped off their front.
They taped it off?
Yeah, they were like, we do not take trick-or-treaters at this house. They had a sign up front and they taped off their whole front yard.
Okay.
It was always sad because sometimes you'd walk by and you'd see the kids in the house just like sitting at the dining room table while we were all having fun.
Yeah. That sucks, man.
Yeah.
Halloween is supposed to be innocent and fun.
It is. It's for kids.
Yeah, it's to get dressed up. And like, my daughter is so hyped for Halloween.
Hell yeah.
She talks about it constantly.
Nice.
She like every morning is like, Halloween, go trick-or-treating. Like, we got costumes.
Nice.
We're going as Paw Patrol.
Oh, sweet.
I literally have a Paw Patrol costume. It looks so ridiculous. But I'm doing it for her because she's so amped about it. And she's just like, this is the first year that she'll really, you know, she's talking and she can really be like, last year we were kind of like carrying her to the door, you know, she's right. Actually can walk up to the door and say trick yeah. or treat. So I'm really excited for it. And she's really excited for it. And that's what it's supposed to be. It's just fun. It's to get free candy as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and hang out with your friends. And
I was lucky enough. I grew up, our street was like the street. Every house handed out candy. People would shuttle in from different neighborhoods just to come to our street. So it was the hypest street to go trick-or-treating. And those were some of my fondest memories, fall memories. Like, it was just so much fun every year. And I can't imagine a community just be completely ruined by this and shutting something down. Like, speaking of football being this community event to bring people up, to get their hopes back up. And then, you know, yeah, Halloween, shutting that down. It's just like, man.
It's doing more harm than good, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You're just further perpetuating the fear.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it completely negates your entire law enforcement. Like, well, they can't keep us safe.
Right,
so
right. I didn't even think about
just stay
that.
Home this year because can't guarantee your safety out there.
Like, no wonder why the gun sales skyrocketed. Yeah, they're basically admitting we're not safe here.
God. Then what happened? Like, maybe it was a good thing though, because what if some teenagers decided to like dress
screw
up as
around.
Like devil worshippers, yeah. You know, started like the black cloaks, hood, and you know, and
right.
started scaring children. You know what I mean? Like, things could go. You know, somebody's got their gun on them,
right, and get freaked out. Yeah,
and somebody happy else trigger finger. Innocent dies.
Right.
So maybe it was a good call ultimately, just based on how heightened everything was. Everybody's fear was just at an all-time high.
That's and maybe it was in response to the heightened gun sales. Maybe it's like, maybe people are a bit like
yeah.
too ready to use these.
Everybody's
weapons,
locked
so,
and loaded. Yeah. Like, don't look like anything evil.
Right.
Assume you're part of this cult.
That's a good point. That's a fair point. So yeah, I mean, to your point, even though many feared that pranks and crimes were about to escalate this year specifically for that Halloween season, the holiday season really passed without problem. It went on as usual. Belmont County Police even put in unpaid overtime to patrol the streets. And like we were saying, many of the locals had kept their firearms close by that night. So as for Nathan's trial, he was ultimately tried as an adult, but since he was still technically a juvenile, the death penalty was out of the picture. He ended up submitting a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, and that is a hard plea to convince a jury. But before the trial, the gag order was lifted and the media was allowed back in court. Nathan was also eventually allowed to visit his parents' grave, and his brothers were also allowed to visit him while he was in jail. On September 30th, 1996, exactly 1 year after the murders, the trial of now 18-year-old Nathan Brooks began. The defense tried to suppress the 35-minute confession he gave to police on the night of the murders. His older brother Jamie also testified on his behalf, and apparently Jamie had received a phone call from Nathan at 4:30 a.m. on the night of the murders. He claimed that Nathan did not seem like the same Nathan he had once known. His speech was slurred, he was groggy, he wouldn't even look him in the eyes when he finally saw him, and he just rambled on and on. Jamie also emphasized that he regretted not getting an attorney for Nathan on the night of the murders, but the judge later ruled that Nathan's confession was given voluntarily, so it was allowed to be used in court. When they later played the confession tape in court, the jury and the crowd were shocked when they heard Nathan laughing at how he described the blood spraying on his shoes when he shot his father in the head. He also admitted he had planned a murder spree to kill everyone that trusted him. And as the confession tape played in court, Nathan was seen crying. Nathan was appointed a public defender, and their goal was to prove that Nathan was legally insane at the time of the murders, but the defense quickly realized that while doing this, they were also portraying Nathan as someone who was incredibly dangerous to society and possibly couldn't be rehabilitated. So it's a double-edged sword there. The defense argued that Nathan's support systems failed to see the warning signs before the attack. They focused on the abuse at the hands of his father, which started at the age of 3. Jamie Brooks took the stand and confirmed that his father was an alcoholic who had physically harmed their mother and bully his sons, but he disagreed with his father being labeled a wife beater. It was also revealed that Belmont County Children's Services reported only 2 incidents of abuse when Nathan was 6, and they claimed that neither report was worthy of following up. Dr. John Mason, who was seen kind of as a small-town celebrity psychologist at the time, he was called to the stand, and he had spent some time with Nathan while he was incarcerated, and he said that he was highly intelligent and knew his potential for evil acts. He also confirmed there were several hit lists that Nathan had created, which had caused some of the confusion during the initial reports. Remember, they were saying, like, oh, there's a list of up to 40 names and things like that. So another list was found by Bruce Young, which was one of Nathan's teachers, and this was found inside Nathan's locker at school. It was near identical to the first note that they found, but on this one, his priest, Father George Yance, was included in this list. And on the list that were all eventually found and compiled, it was always Ryan, Marilyn, and Terry at the top. And Dr. Mason said that the only reason Ryan was still alive was because of Nathan's obsessive tendencies. Basically, since Ryan was out of the house the whole night, that threw off a very specific plan he had, which was why he's racing around town and was made the weird note with the money in it, because he was just scrambling at the end. Then, since Ryan was supposed to be home and he was supposed to kill all 3 of them. Dr. Mason also claimed that Nathan's first memory was seeing his father strike his mother. And since he was about 5 years old, he had always felt a compulsion to kill. He acted on this compulsion early by catching a fish, nailing it to a board, and watching it wiggle as it died. Dr. Mason went on to say that Nathan resented his mother because she had ignored the abuse throughout the years, and he saw his father as Satan in a way. And Nathan had told Dr. Mason that he had killed his father because he was, quote, a lonely dude. And Nathan also said that his favorite book was Paradise Lost, and he actually sympathized with Satan because he was, quote, a lonely dude. So he drew some parallels between Satan and his father.
Which I think this is all, like, critical to understanding Nathan and what happened. It provides a much more logical, you know, it doesn't explain everything by any means, but it definitely... Because I think when anything this horrific happens, I think there's often going to be some tidbits of information from their past that's going to help provide at least a little bit of clarity on how did we get to this point. And the fact that he's seeing family violence at such a young age, I mean, I can't even imagine the impact that that has on somebody. But then it just becomes, you know, if it's not dealt with, if they're not in therapy, they're not given ways to deal with this trauma that they experience, it can easily spiral out of control. And then obviously the outside influences come into play. And, you know, it doesn't take long before things go bad. I mean, we've seen so many examples of this over the years, in many other cases similar to this, where, you know, they're still a kid. They're still a developing child at this point. Mm-hmm. And obviously it never excuses what they do, because clearly he's old enough to understand the gravity of the situation. And, you know, everybody learns one way or another, you know, that you never kill anybody, let alone use violence to solve problems. But it does seem like he just went kind of undetected for too long, and it was too late before. Well,
and then even when he was detected and people were calling his mother, it was like, oh, yeah, it's just a phase, right? So it was just never directly addressed by the right people.
Let's talk about what the prosecution said. They argue that Nathan was not insane and knew exactly what he was doing at the time of the murders. They pointed out that Nathan had hidden the hunting rifle from his father before the attack, and they argue that Nathan had a, quote, conduct disorder, as seen by his petty crime. Nathan had also admitted to hurting his friends from an early age. The prosecution then argued that the satanic ritual aspect of the murder was just a ruse and that Nathan was a, quote unquote, highly intelligent person who controls and intimidates others easily. As for determining his sanity, Nathan had been given a test when he was 17, but two psychologists during the trial said that it was a test catered for adults, so the results couldn't be trusted. They also claimed that he knew the wrongfulness of his actions because when police first picked him up, he reportedly said, quote, "I know I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done it." And this was only a few hours after the murders. Which,
pretty clear, right?
Very clear, yeah. The defense argued that planning to perform a murder spree against people who trusted him and using sacrificial blood, including his own, was not the behavior of a sane teenager. Plus, they tried to get the jury to sympathize with Nathan because he had expressed remorse for the murders, and he also left behind money for his younger brother, Ryan. This argument backfired for the defense because even though they were trying to garner sympathy, they reinforced the point that Nathan had shown remorse because he understood the wrongfulness of his actions. Again, makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I'm curious as to why they went with that defense, you know?
He might have had a bad lawyer is what I'm picking up on.
Most likely. And it seems like just a dumb move because he already said, basically, I knew what I did was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, did they have that information or what happened there exactly? The defense called a neurologist to the stand who claimed that Nathan suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, illusions of grandeur, obsessive compulsive behavior disorder, and hallucinations. If we go back to him smelling rotting flesh, rotting meat, the neurologist claimed that Nathan suffered from an abnormal blood flow pattern in the brain and suffered from migraines throughout his life. Apparently, Nathan had been knocked out before while playing football, which might have contributed to these complications, possibly. Dr. John Mason agreed with these results. He also emphasized that Nathan suffered from antisocial personality disorder as well, and after speaking with Nathan, after he had undergone therapy during his time in jail, he determined that he was still a danger to himself as well as the public. During these interviews, Nathan had expressed interest in killing one of his female friends who had come to visit him while in jail. He spent 20 minutes detailing how he would do it, even saying that she would enjoy it. This young woman was present during the trial, and she left the courtroom in tears. On top of all this, Nathan told Dr. Mason that his initial plan was to commit suicide after the murders, and he believed that Satan would bring him back to life, which would also subsequently make him that much more powerful. Meanwhile, outside the courtroom, the local media proposed the theory that Nathan had to have been insane to commit such a crime. On October 21st, 1996, Nathan Brooks was found guilty for the murders of his parents, and he showed no emotion at the reading of the verdict. As he was led from the courtroom, the rest of the Brooks family and extended family gathered and embraced each other. After the family left, the young woman that was mentioned before stayed behind in the courtroom, and it's been suggested that she may have had a romantic relationship with Nathan at the time. 3 days later, on October 24th, 1996, Nathan was sentenced to 40 years to life with the possibility of parole after 30 years, an additional 3 years for a related gun charge. Witnesses claimed that he had been seen joking around with the sheriffs at the time of his sentencing, and he seemed uninterested in what was going on. His aunt said, quote, "We love him and we will always stand by him. I hope he doesn't fall through the cracks in prison." A few days later, it was Halloween again in Bel Air. Trick-or-treating was limited from between 6 to 7 p.m., but not for safety reasons. The community loved the Boo Bash so much from the previous year that they needed to make time to do it all again. The church and the local fire department hosted the event that ran for many more years to come. So it just kind of became a tradition after all this.
Yeah, I think it was hard to find. I think COVID shut it down and they haven't done it since, but it went for a really long time after this. So like 20 some years after this event.
But today, Nathan Brooks is incarcerated at the London Correctional Institution in Ohio. His crimes have faded from the national spotlight, but they'll never be forgotten in the local community of Bel Air. His crimes still stand as some of the most horrific murders ever carried out in Belmont County, and the fallout of the local satanic panic in the mid-90s won't soon be forgotten. Currently, Nathan Brooks has spent over half of his life in prison, According to the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections of Ohio, he is 46 years old and will be eligible for parole on September 18th, 2025, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, within a year.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot to unpack here. It's it's a very, there's just so many things going on. I think this is definitely a deeply disturbed individual.
Yeah.
On so many levels.
And this case is so complex that I, you know, I get what you were saying earlier, where it's like the people that go like he was demonically possessed, I almost understand it, because it's like, how do you rationalize something like this? Considering the nature of the murders, how do you say like, yeah, this was somebody who just snapped, or this person was sane and knew what they were doing, like a 17-year-old child, right? What do you take away from this? How does something like this really happen?
I look at what the psychologists presented, because I think there's clearly something mentally going on. You know what I mean? And it's unfortunate, I think, that people go with the demonic possession in this case, because I think that's likely not,
it just not really undermines
the reality. It undermines the reality. Yeah. I think there's definitely, I mean, they literally found that he had abnormal blood patterns in the brain,
right?
Suffer from migraines.
Someone who's huffing cans of butane, like clearly something's wrong.
Homemade, right? LSD. I mean, you're talking about substances that are going to have pretty profound effects on the brain, and your brain is still developing at this age, you know. And
he was saying he was using it to suppress those obsessive thoughts, where at the same time it was probably exacerbating those thoughts as well.
Yeah, you couple that with underlying mental health conditions. I think it's just a perfect storm of all these terrible things coming together, and then you couple in the abuse he's dealing with at home and during his childhood, and he's clearly angry. I mean, he's clearly, you know, he's got this list of people that he wants to take out, that he feels like did him wrong in one way or another.
That's also goes against the theory of this demonic possession. A lot of people were saying like, oh, it was all of a sudden and he blacked out and this possession took a hold of him. But that list shows it was premeditated, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the biggest evidence here. He also planned everything out. He hid the gun.
The weapons, yeah.
He strategically did this when they went to sleep. It's not like he just randomly like walked in one day. So it's like really? Like a demon like perfectly planned this out, helped him do all this? Like in other cases, you know, when talking about cases where demonic possession comes into play, I feel when it's just a random act and there's no explanation, there's clearly no pre-planning going on here, they just snap, things unfold, an argument can be made from that perspective, maybe a little bit more. But with this, it seems like this was a long time coming. You know what I mean? This is something he clearly thought about, obsessed about for a long, long time, and then he finally acted on it when he felt like he had all the pieces in place here. And then again, he even was like, basically was like, no, I'm not I'm not this satanic cult member.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he kind of disowned alone. All that. And yeah, he was like, even though he was into this stuff, he never like reinforced that idea at all, or never mentioned other names or other people that he was inspired by or anything like that.
If anything, it was the opposite. He was picked up and he was like, I did it. This was wrong. I should be punished, basically, is what he was saying when the police picked him up. So yeah, it's funny because the rumor mill then proposed an idea that was exactly opposite of that, which I think is why we still have the residual theories of demonic possession and some paranormal stuff going on, is because of just the sheer rumors.
It's the rumors, and then the nature of the crime, I think, sometimes people like to explain away.
Yeah.
How could somebody do this to their own parents if they're not demonically possessed?
Right.
Like, there's no way somebody would enact this type of violence on somebody they love. And but that's just not the case.
Yeah, because it's harder to admit that, no, this is just a human behaving
right.
way outside of the normal patterns that we often do. But yeah, this has nothing to do with the devil. Well,
no, I mean,
metaphorically maybe
yeah.
it does, but.
But I mean, humans are capable of evil beyond comprehension without demons involved or you know, anything else for that matter. I mean, people are just, some people are just evil, you know?
Yeah.
They're just,
you're wired different. And I think also harming animals from a young age, that's like a tale as old as time, right?
Yeah.
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Right.
You know, you could go back to any of those big serial killers back in the day. That's like a huge indication is killing, mutilating animals.
And is he just a copycat and he's learning about this and so he then is doing this? Or
he did have those books, so he would know about it.
Is he kind of feeling like he's finding his identity through these other killers? And maybe it's in his mind, it was helping explain the way that he is and the way that he saw the world. And, you know, maybe he felt like that was his true identity. And, you know, once he kind of found himself in all of that, he became committed to it, you know, and just really like, I don't know. It's really hard to explain because obviously none of us have been on that other side and have no way of knowing what it'd be like to be in that position. But there's definitely underlying issues going on here. Cause I mean, then there's, you know, some people go so hard on the demonic possession to the point of like, now the house is haunted,
mm-hmm.
And that there's demonic entities that are continuing to exist there, which is insane. You know, paranormal investigators have gone and
mm-hmm.
gotten EVPs of voices mentioning his name, and it's just like
standing over the victim's grave with these devices. You're like, all right, let's calm down with this.
It goes too far. You know what I mean? Where it's like it begins to take away from the horrific tragedy that took place here.
Right.
And clouding it up with all this, you know, belief, you know, based evidence, you know, and I know paranormal investigators are like, this is evidence of the supernatural, but it's like, we've done it.
Yeah.
We've done, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's,
and this is coming from the Lights Out guys.
Yeah.
We love the paranormal.
I love
stuff
the paranormal.
Here, but we know where to draw the line where it's like, okay.
I just think whenever you're talking about like something as so recent as this and to try to explain away something, you know, I think the paranormal makes a lot more sense in cases where there is nothing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When there's a lack of evidence. There's a lack of physical, tangible evidence here, and there's just no explanation, which it's, you know, a rare thing, but that's where
it fills that void.
Yeah, like sometimes the paranormal can come in and perhaps add some possible theories as to what may have happened. But I think when it's as clear as it is in this case of how things unfolded, and you can clearly see the stepping stones from the beginning to the end here, and then try to explain away this was demonic possession that caused him to do this when there's so much other evidence to suggest otherwise. I think it's just doing more harm than good and harm towards the victim's family and those personally affected by it and in their healing process. Because whenever you're like, yeah, we picked up an EVP mentioning Nathan's name, you know, you're just continuing the panic pain. And the fear and the pain. To continue. And then you're also interesting other people to go and do the same. And what was interesting too, is that I thought this aspect of it is out there for sure, but I wanted to mention it because I thought it was a little bit interesting. So Nathan's house is located under high voltage power lines.
I remember this part. Yeah.
And this was kind of interesting. And I was like, I've heard about this before. And there's, you know, there's certain laws around how close you can build a dwelling, especially a residence, to these high voltage power lines. We're talking about like not just like a little power pole in the neighborhood. We're talking about like the gigantic multi-level high voltage power lines. And his house was actually located very, very close to these, almost underneath them in some regards, because you could go outside and hear the electricity. And so these high voltage power lines, they're the EMFs are a lot higher than, say, somewhere with just a traditional power line. And there's a lot of controversy around the effects that these, you know, these high EMFs can have on the human brain. But there have been scientific studies done that have shown potentially cancerous tumors developing, especially in children. And because I thought, well, if he's suffering from migraines, is it perhaps could be partly as a result of living in these conditions near these power lines? But where, you know, and I'm thinking of it more of along the lines of, you know, we all hear about EMFs, and, you know, EMFs are bad for you. You got to, you know, protect yourself from your cell phone and your microwave and everything. Like, some people take it like a little too far. There's just not enough scientific evidence there. I'm not saying that it's not something you should look into or be concerned about, but then there's people who took, well, because there's these high voltage power lines above his house, this provided an energy source for these demons that were, you know, dwelling within the Brooks residence, and they're still there, and there's still this evil presence there, and it just kind of like the legend continues, you know what I
right,
mean?
Yeah. And so, I don't buy the power line thing for a multitude of reasons, not to be a total stinker about it, but it's also like there were other people living in that neighborhood in that house that didn't commit something like this, you know?
Which, to be fair, I think everybody levels of exposure to this is different depending on who you are and what you're, you know, predisposed to perhaps. And, you know, it can get really complicated when talking about, because, you know, I have seen in the past where when 5G's tower started going up, there was some reports though of like people getting cancer actually that were right near, because they were like at first is like plopping them down right next to schools, and right, there was some spikes in it, but it was so few and far between that it got immediate. You know, when something, you know, you kind of have this isolated anomaly, then people immediately jump and are like,
to it's connect everywhere. Dots.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And that's where it gets
a
little slippery. But
it's also like, you know, if you want to connect cancer, we have real corporations who have done serious damage to the environment, like Dow Chemical dumping into our Great Lakes and, you know, causing excess levels of cancer there. So like, I'm not. So like, I don't disregard all those theories right out of the gate. But as far as the electrical lines connecting to Nathan Brooks, exactly, I don't really buy it.
Yeah. It's a major stretch. And I think it just further feeds the paranormal narrative.
Right. Right. Through that lens. Fine. I get it. Like with the EMF levels, through more tangible physical evidence, I can't really abide by that. I think there's clearly way more tangible things going on in his life that would explain what happened more so than the power lines. That's just my take on
totally,
it.
Totally. Seems like there's deep-rooted issues there.
Yeah.
From an early age that went untreated, undealt with, that eventually spiraled out of control.
That's not to say there isn't multifaceted problems, totally, right? Yeah. There could be a lot of layers there.
Well, that's I think our whole point is that you can't just like chalk this up to one thing or another.
Right. Right.
That's just so, these situations are so complex and multifaceted. I think you're doing a disservice by just like pointing to one thing.
And agreed. And like,
it's this.
Yeah.
You know, he was possessed by demons and this is why this horrible tragedy happened. I think that's a dangerous thing to do.
Bit reductive. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, we obviously want to know your thoughts on this. And, you know, I hope the rest of the Brooks family is doing the best they possibly can, dealing with this. And it will be, we'll see what happens next year, with Nathan. And see.
So, yeah, what, if you had to guess,
I think the likelihood of him being paroled is probably pretty slim.
Yeah.
If I had to guess, but I don't know.
We don't really know his behavior throughout his prison stint, but yeah, if I had to guess with something as horrific as this, I would, probably bet no, he will not be getting out on parole, but who's to say? Obviously, like I said, I don't really know him or his journey, like how far he's come from those days.
Right.
So it's been a long time.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, nothing excuses what he did, you know, it's just never needed to happen. There was no reason for any of it. But yeah, let us know what your thoughts are on Nathan Brooks and why did he do what he did? But we're going to go ahead and wrap up today's episode there. Make sure you subscribe to the channel if you're not already. Head over to Signal and throw us a vote if you're feeling kind. We'd really appreciate it. But we'll catch you next week with another one. We've got a great paranormal episode coming up, right?
Yeah. I'm excited for more paranormal. I think for the rest of October.
Yes.
It's all going to be the spooky paranormal.
We got a great Halloween special in the works for you.
Oh, yeah.
Which we definitely are going all out for. So should be a good month, but we'll see you guys next time. Until then, lights out, everybody.